40 years ago, 30.
Yeah, it was overgrown somewhat now, but... So, a couple of paperwork things here. As I mentioned before, this is a recap, but I've got those transcripts that are getting typed up of the interview.
Yeah.
And I've got the first ones in there, type form back from the typist, and I'm just going to review those and pop those into the mail, hopefully within, say, 10 days or so to you.
Uh-huh.
And you can tell me what I got right and wrong and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The second thing is, I'm going to, and I have deposited the first tapes at the Yukon Archives.
You're going to what?
I am going to deposit the tapes at the Yukon Archives.
Yep.
And they like to have, they got miles of paperwork, but they want to have a release anyway, saying that you and I agree to deposit these things, and we're not going to come back and claim $1 million for them or something, copyright, that sort of stuff. So I need to. I wrote up a simple form for that, and I will send it to you with the transcripts.
Okay.
I think that's all the paperwork. Now I've got the tape running now, so we'll just sort of do this intro stuff again. Introduction. This is Colin Bairstow, and I'm on the telephone interviewing Gordon Cameron about Yukon Aviation Heritage and Mr. Cameron's time and knowledge from his years involved in aviation in Yukon. I'm in Whitehorse, and Mr. Cameron is in Edmonton. Is it coming over fairly clearly now?
It's a lot better now, but once in a while you break up a little.
Okay, just let me know if I'm misbehaving here.
So
just a couple of detail things, and then as I mentioned, I have sort of some more broad questions for the end there. I was looking through some old late 40s newspapers, and I came across an ad for an outfit, I think, called Whelan's Aircraft Maintenance.
Oh, yeah.
1947.
Right.
Weiland.
Yeah.
Does that ring a bell, or do you...
Oh, yeah, sure. Harry Whelan used to work for us at CPA.
Right.
And he's a big, friendly sort of fella. He had quite an accent. He's a Dane, I think.
Right.
And had a hell of a time getting his engineer's license. He finally went back to Ottawa, and he showed up back in Whitehorse, and he had his license, so I think. I found out later, apparently, he had a relative or something down there. But anyway, he wasn't a natural engineer. I mean, he was, for example, we found out very early that we couldn't let him change spark plugs. He'd wind the inserts right out. He was a terrific, powerful guy.
Right.
And he'd throw a terrific amount of torque into a spark plug wrench, and what he did was he went to do some maintenance, like he hired on to do maintenance for Yukon Flying Service.
Right.
And that's what that ad was about, and I don't know, he didn't do it for very long, but looked after a couple of airplanes. I don't know which ones even, but...
Right. Just occurred to me as an aside, I forgot to give the date on the tape, and today's date is August 14th, 2002, right?
Right.
Okay, sorry about that. Now back, another little tidbit. I came across an outfit called Prospectors Airways, sort of in 1955, 1956, 1957.
Yeah.
In the phone book, actually. And who were they?
Well, that was, I think that was Eric Nielsen and Bobby Austin and Jim Stretch, I think, or Fred Stretch, and Harry Gordon Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
and they brought in a Stag-Owing Beechcraft.
Wow.
CFHSK. It was from Pacific Western Airlines
mm-hmm.
on floats, and they fiddled around with that for 2 or 3 years. In fact, Harry Gordon Cooper turned it upside down in Telegraph Creek and broke both top wings. I went down and examined it and found the spars were split on both top wings, but it was good enough to ferry back to Whitehorse.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric sent out to U.S. War Surplus, I guess, and he got two brand new wings still in the crate with the silver filler paint on, dope on it, and brought them up. And so I sprayed the whole airplane, painted the whole airplane. It was a deep red, and I repainted it all yellow with black trim on it, and put the wings back on. And then they used it again for a while. They used it for a while on wheels. Then they put it on floats, and they were going to take it out of Vancouver to sell, and Harry Gordon Cooper was going to take it out, and he didn't pump the floats out, and one float was half full of water, and it dragged him over to one side of the river down there, and he hit the pilings and bust in the nose of one float and also the trailing edge of the lower wings, the left or right lower wing.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, so I bought the thing finally.
Mm-hmm.
And patched it up and flew it. I was going to fly it on wheels, and then I had trouble with the brakes and so on. Weren't very good, and so I put it back on floats, and I flew it 2 or 3 times on floats, and then I sold it to a fellow named Jack Bergeron, and he was living in Whitehorse at the time, but he later started the flying service in Fort McMurray.
Wow.
And he, in turn, sold it to Don Hamilton, who has the air spray bombers.
Wow.
And Don Hamilton had a summer cottage out in the Shuswap, and he used the Stag-Owing to fly out to Shuswap Lake and so on. And then the last time I saw it, it was sitting with the engine out on wheels on the municipal airport in Edmonton, and the engine was out. He was using Stearman biplanes for bug spray in those days, and he packed up an engine, so he needed a spare engine, so he got one right away by taking it out of the beach and slapping it into one of his
Stearman's, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, that's Prospector Airways deal.
So HSK left Yukon at what point then? Jack Bergeron, when Bergeron...
He left, I think...
Was Hamilton in Yukon?
Pardon?
Did Don Hamilton operate in Yukon?
No, well, he still has airplanes up there in the summer for firefighting.
Right.
But, no, he was in Edmonton, and Bergeron flew the airplane out to Edmonton and sold it to Don, and I guess I think he flew for Don for a while, and then he went up to Fort McMurray and started Contact Airways.
Wow.
And I don't know, I've lost track of him lately. He retired since he made himself a lot of money, and retired a number of years ago. I don't know where he lives now. But Prospectors Airways, that was sort of the end of it. They didn't have much success in prospecting.
So they had just the one aircraft?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they only had the one aircraft, but I'm just trying to think. There was a Naraka sedan,
right?
That I think that's the one that maybe it wasn't Prospector Airways. That was another Larry Patton, Ode, and Fred Stretch, and some of those. But I'm not just sure now on the makeup of those two outfits. But one of them had a Naraka Champ,
mm-hmm.
and then I know that Eric Nielsen and Harry Gordon Cooper and those fellows, they had the Stag-Owing.
Right.
And also Harold Hine was in on it too. He's one of the lawyers.
With Prospector?
No, he was, I guess, with Prospector too. But he was Eric Nielsen's partner.
Right.
Was Van Robin, Nielsen, and Hine.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And so they called themselves Prospector Airways. That was an indication of the business they were trying to develop?
Yeah, that was a separate business. They were trying to do prospecting, you know.
So So they were into prospecting themselves, or just
well, sort of they didn't like Harry Gordon Cooper and forget who else now did the actual prospecting. Eric Nielsen flew them around in the airplane.
Okay.
And Harry Gordon Cooper flew them around the airplane.
Right.
And I didn't get, you know, I wasn't really involved in them. I knew they were there, and I knew the guys, but I didn't get
right
wrapped up in their operation that much.
Of course, you know, they were just another business in town. Or,
yeah.
Well, switching now, I'm not sure, I don't think I've asked you about the great Wellesley Lake B-24 and your opinion of that.
Well, all I've ever heard, you know, I just hearsay, like Bob has told me stories about it, but I've never had anyone prove it. Some people claim in calm weather, glassy smooth, you can actually see one wingtip. But as far as I know, it's still there. Different people have tried to make a deal. Bob, in fact, was trying to make a deal for a Barclay in Calgary that was used to be out of Whitehorse,
mm-hmm.
Barclay Grow,
right?
And give the guy the rights to the B-24, and they'd give him the museum up there, the Barclay. But I guess that thing fell through.
Do you have any recollection of an incident involving a B-24 from the wartime?
Not a B-24, no.
No, okay.
No.
Another one that's not a big mystery, but of interest, and I just thought to see if you had any knowledge from the time the crash, was the B-17 that crashed. Sort of just not the car cross one, the north of 1952 north of Coffee Creek.
I never did see that, but I heard about it. I knew my Pat Collison had been in and had looked at it,
right?
Went in on the top of a hill somewhere there.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened. I don't know whether they're all killed or whatever happened.
No, I think
during the war.
Yeah, well, 1952. Yeah, they were searching for another aircraft. I think.
Maybe I think it was all part of the search for that C-54, I guess.
Oh yeah, one of those big searches.
Hmm?
I think it might have been either the C-54 or the B-25, the Mitchell.
I don't think it was the B-25. That was the Canadian Air Force B-25.
Yeah.
The one that hit
Black Ram Peak.
They were?
They called it now Black Ram Peak.
Well, it was on the way to Mayo there. It was, hell, I can't think of the name of the mountain now.
Yeah, in the MacArthur's.
In the MacArthur group, yeah, that's right.
Right.
And it was Ray McCamey was the one that spotted. He was a prospector.
Right.
And he was also a member of the Territorial Council.
Oh, yeah.
And he was prospecting there and came across, noticed this bloody tire.
Mm-hmm.
Followed the trail of junk and garbage and came to the B-25. That was, well, I think that was over 2 years later. There was nothing but skeletons.
Yeah. So, shifting again now to closer to your vocation, I'm in the aircraft industry and engineering. I'm wondering, what was the first aircraft you remember working on?
That I remember working on?
Yeah.
Oh, that would be a Kenner Bird in Vancouver, I guess.
Right. A Bird.
Kenner Bird.
Right.
And a Fleet Model 2
mm-hmm.
biplane, and a couple of Luscombs when they first came out.
Mm-hmm.
Belonged to Foggins Flying Service. And I worked there on weekends and on holidays. And then when I went north, when I hired on with the BYN Company Air Service, I went up the coast on the Princess Nora, and the aircraft I worked on then was a Fairchild 82, the first one ever built, in fact, CFAXA, and Curtis Condor, BQN, and Travel Air 6000, BPV, that's one that the fellow I went to Yukon with was killed in that.
Mm-hmm.
same summer I got up there.
So what? And the first, so the first one in Whitehorse would have been the.
Well, there was BQN, which was a Curtis Condor.
Right.
The only one in Canada.
Right.
And BPV, which was we called the Jeep. It was a Travel Air 6000.
Right.
And a. Well, I think probably the Fairchild 82 was brought up from Wings.
Mm-hmm.
Rex tightly flew it up and flew it for a while. It was and I don't remember whether that was there first or maybe it was the Pilgrim that the superintendent Ev Wasson up in Alaska and brought it down from Fairbanks and so there was that was. And just before I got there, of course, like I got there on the 15th of March, the 23rd of December, that Christmas, there was when the new big black Airbus burnt up in the hangar.
Right.
And it was just still smoldering when I got up there.
So what was the first helicopter you worked on? Do you remember this first machine sort of thing? Or?
Well, it was a Bell 42.
Bell 42?
42, yeah.
Wow.
And a little old bubble.
Right.
Bell.
Right.
And,
that would have been where?
In Dawson City.
Right.
And then the Hiller 12E.
Mm-hmm.
We had four Bell 42s, and we ended up, I think, with three or four Hiller 12Es.
You mean Bell 47s?
47, I mean, yeah,
right.
Bell 47.
Right.
And, then I went down to California on a helicopter course and, with the Hiller factory.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to the base from Dawson into Whitehorse. I had an overhaul and repair shop there, and so they moved everything. They bought my equipment and moved the operation down to a main office down to Whitehorse.
As an engineer, what was sort of the best aircraft that you worked on? I mean, what did you consider to be the best aircraft that sort of stood out in your mind? Aircraft or type?
I don't really know. It's hard to say.
Right.
I don't know that I would pick one out over any other, really. They're all...
In terms of design or anything, I know I'm...
Interesting to work on.
As a...
Found helicopters more interesting than aircraft because they were much more of a challenge. You know, they were, as they say, it was like a bumblebee. They were never meant to fly. And you had all sorts of, you know, what they called one-to-one vibration and high freaks and so on. And a one-to-one was main blade vibration, which gave you a challenge to checking things out down to the transmission. And then a high freak you felt in your feet, which was a... It was a high-frequency vibration of the tail rotor.
Right.
And that kept you kind of scratching your head to see what the hell was wrong.
So those would be, that would be feedback you'd get from the pilot. They'd say, I got a one-to-one, and you'd have to go
find it. Yeah, he'd come in and say, yeah, he's got a one-to-one. Wish you knew it was the top end, and and a high-freak or vibration in his feet was the tail rotor and the tail rotor drive shaft. Right? Stood up in there, so.
Right.
It kept you... searching, and it was kind of interesting because those little old airplanes were all wide open. There was nothing, you didn't have to remove a whole bunch of metal to get at anything, you know.
You just,
it was all right there in front of you.
Handy to work on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm sort of basing my question on some of my own experience. I'm not a pilot, but I worked on farms for a few years, and John Deere tractors always seem to be easier to, well, to drive and work with, partly based on their design, I think. You know, you take a look at the brake pedal, and it's got one nice curved piece of metal as opposed to three different bits of something, rather with a cotter pin on a Ford or something, you know. So,
well, I go along with you there. I was out, in fact, just this last weekend, I was busy mowing the grass in the area where we keep our trailer out of the Lac St. Anne.
Right.
And the fellow has it, a John Deere. And a lawnmower, and it's a hell of a good outfit there. I think they call it, it's hydraulically operated. Everything is hydraulic, it's very instantaneous.
Yes.
And go forward and back, and you can turn in a dime and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
John Deere, no doubt, there. I think they're the Cadillac of farm machinery and lawnmowers. And, and that sort of stuff.
Did you have any similar impressions or feelings about particular aircraft? I guess.
Of course, the engine in those days, the engines you flew for a couple hours and you worked on them for about 4 hours. There was always leaking oil, and you had a lot of problems. Like, there's nothing they don't have any problem today.
Yeah.
And as things improved, like I think probably my favorite engine to working with and flying behind everything was the R985 Pratt & Whitney Wasp Jr., which is was in the Barclay Inn, was in Twin Beaches, and was in the Beaver and the 82, and that was a pretty reliable, pretty faithful engine. And then the aircraft themselves, the DC-3 and the Boeing 247, they were very reliable, good airplanes to work on.
So the Pratt & Whitney Jr. Why was it so reliable, do you think?
Well, it was well built. It was take a lot of punishment, and it didn't require really that much maintenance. You just did your preventative maintenance, and changed the oil, and this sort of stuff, and it just kept on going.
Right.
And the worst engine, the worst of them all, was a bloody what they called a Shaky Jake. Jacob's engine, which was a combination of an automobile distributor and a magneto, a combination of the two.
Right.
First airplane to work on, I think, was engine-wise, was the Staggering Beechcraft. The engine was up against the firewall, and they had to build out the firewall into the cockpit in order to put the accessories like the starters and generator and that sort of thing. And you had to take panels off in under the dashboard to get at mag points, this sort of thing, and there was no space. It was about 3 inches between the back of the engine and the exhaust ring and the firewall. It was a terrible thing. And the easiest one to work on, which was the lousy Shaky Jake, but it was in a Cessna 195, which you just pulled a couple of pins and the mount was hinged and had all flex lines and all the connections, and you could wheel the engine out and get at it just a piece of cake. So there was some good and some bad. The old Condor had Wrights in it. It had Wright whirlwinds, 575 horse each. And before you'd leave, you'd have to go out and crawl in behind the prop there and pull a lever and check your watch for 20 seconds to lubricate the rocker arms. And you did that on each engine. Then when they got to Dawson, you did it again before you came back to White Horse. And then eventually they put on lubricators that solved that, and things improved.
That was pretty high maintenance.
Hmm?
That was pretty high maintenance, those old Wright whirlwinds, holy smokes.
Yeah. And also, I Wright engine, Wright, the J69E, or the 330 horse J6 engine, which was Ford tri-motor, and we had a whole bunch of them when I went up there. They had two Ford tri-motor sets, plus the one out of the one that was hit with a hurricane in Vancouver.
Right.
I think we had about 9 or 10 or 12 engines, J6 engines. They were a pretty good engine for Wrights, and the big Wrights, we had some big Wrights in the Lockheed Lodestars, and I hated them because particularly summer or winter, you had to turn by hand in order to clear out the bottom cylinders with oil, and God, those things with 9 cylinders and a single row, and there was no overlap, and you could chin yourself on the prop pretty well, trying to get them turned around. Whereas the twin-row Pratt & Whitneys that they eventually had in all our Lodestars were great because there was an overlap on the firing order, and you just kept pushing away at them and turning them over.
So when you had to get all the oil out in the wintertime, was that the deal, you mean? Or
what's that?
When were you trying to get all the oil out?
Well, the oil tends to drain down in a radial engine, tends to the lower cylinders.
Right.
It picks it up, most of it in the sump, but a lot of it dribbles over into the two bottom cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't want to try firing up with that in there because it would hydraulic the connecting rod and, really bugger up your engine.
I gotcha.
So you turned it slowly and it
By hand?
Push the oil out through the exhaust.
And you had to do that by hand?
Pardon?
How you would turn...
By hand.
By hand.
Yep.
You're grabbing the prop by hand and trying
By hand, yep. And then once you got that clear, then you go ahead and start on the starter.
You build up some biceps doing that, I guess.
Pardon? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got fairly muscular.
Yeah. So I wonder who would be the most notable engineer or engineers that you worked with?
Oh, gee.
Oh, my tape's... Oh, no. Sorry, I thought my tape was cutting out. It's still going. Sorry. Continue.
Well, I don't know. There were some... fellas that, they became pilots that were damn good engineers.
Right.
Jack Rennie and Stan Emery, and these fellas were great engineers, and then they became pilots.
Yeah.
And, I can't think of anyone. I think they were all pretty good.
Right.
Pretty good boys, and,
Yeah. What about, can you think of what might be the most significant aviation events that you'd been a part of or seen in the Yukon?
You're breaking up again.
Sorry. The most significant aviation event.
Most significant what event?
Aviation.
Oh, aviation event?
In Yukon that you've seen.
Oh.
Seen or...
No. I think operations they had up there, like the military operations they had, Sweetbriar was one that comes to mind, and there was two or three of them, and they had aircraft come in from, they had Canadian aircraft up, they had Gloucester Meteors and Mustangs, and then they had aircraft come in from Alaska, sneak in and try and catch off guard, you know, on the White Horse, and they'd come screaming in over the housetops, and I mean really low, within, you know, about 5 feet practically, and about 300 miles an hour. It was quite exciting. And they had two or three of those military operations. And then they had, I remember when they had a bond drive in the wintertime, and they had, Canadian Air Force had two Norsemen on skis at the airport there, and an American, one fella that flew it was an American fella, and the hell was his name anyway, and then another guy named Crosley, they called him the little man. He was a little guy, but he'd been a bush pilot for years, and so they had a little bit of a parade downtown, and so he took the Norseman and went out and went across town just about airport level, because I was standing in the airport, and I was just about eye level with him, and he was just looping all the way down the valley.
Jeez.
Round.
In a Norseman.
With a Norseman, yeah, that was quite a feat.
On skis.
Huh?
Norseman on skis.
On skis, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
So,
My tape, I'm going to just flip my tape over here, if you just bear with me for 2 seconds. So, we were talking about memorable events, and you were talking about the Norseman doing rolls down the valley.
Doing loops, yeah.
Loops.
Yeah, but and I guess one of the most remembering time of mine was my first jet ride was in an F-89 Scorpion, and they were a two-place cockpit job with a coupe top and two 7,500 horse engines under your bottom. And they were a combination fighter-bomber.
Right.
And it was a great trip. This guy said, "Do you want to go up in the jet?" I said, "Sure." So we tore around the mountains there. He says, "We'll go looking for a moose." I thought, "This is silly as hell. We're going about 450 miles an hour." And we tore around for about an hour or so.
Right. Yeah, I think you mentioned that story. That, I would like that trip, I think, yeah.
Yeah. So it was really, it was a good ride. Interesting.
Could you talk a little bit more about the exercises that involved White Horse, or using White Horse as a venue, they say today?
The military would set set up these operations, and they'd have soldiers and airmen and so on in there. It's just sort of like a mock war idea. They'd come over with the they try and get the aircraft off the ground fast enough, and Whitehorse, if they had good indications that there were enemy aircraft coming in, and the enemy aircraft were usually sometimes there were T-33s, and other times there were those. So I can't remember the now. There were 63s, were they? There were been Mustangs anyway. Two Mustangs joined together,
right?
And they'd come racing in. They're all black, and they'd come screaming in over the top of the hills there above Fish Lake and try and sneak in.
Did they practice bomb?
No, if they did, they didn't indicate. There was nothing on the ground. They might have had electronic indication of some kind.
And they didn't sort of have troops trying to sneak up on the airport sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right.
They actually had ground troops trying to sneak up and
No, I don't think there were any ground troops. Well, there were troops around, you know, because there was military involved in the area at the time. But this was at the... It was after the war.
What were the most important supports for aviation in the Yukon? I'm thinking maybe government or industry or technology. What were what was out there that was assisting you in your aviation endeavors?
You mean government-wise?
Well, or in the industry or technology, was there anything out there that was helping you? Or you were pretty much, in terms of government, maybe, or...
We didn't have much help as far as government was concerned. Of course, as the aircraft improved, I mean, that made a difference. We started out with the old Fairchild 71, and then we kind of got a Beaver, and finally got a Norseman. That was pretty classy aircraft for the Bush. And, we poked away on our own, and we did we scrounged as much government flying as we could.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a hell of a lot of it. Most of it was private and mining, and caribou counting, and game work, and medical stuff, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we were pretty well on our own. There was White Horse Flying Services Limited, and there was Yukon Flying Service, and they finally then went belly up, and we were growing, and we had to get, enlarge ourselves, so we decided to amalgamate with them, and I don't think that was a particularly good idea, because we didn't have a smart enough lawyer at the time. He was a brand new lawyer, George Van Ragen. He later became a senator, as a matter of fact.
You mentioned that you had mentioned the structure of the amalgamation was not advantageous for you guys.
No. Well, it wasn't, because of the way it was set up. Instead of setting up with a sort of an escape clause where we could take the others or be bought out, or take the others out at a pre-established price.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of that, the harder we bust our buns work, the more everybody got... made money on it, like the ones that weren't doing anything. There was only three of us that were working.
Right.
And yet there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
Were all making extra money.
Right.
So it wasn't good that way.
So what changed in the 20 years? That you were sort of directly involved there in Yukon Aviation.
Say again, what
changed? I guess you've already talked about the technology to a certain extent, but what were the changes in aviation over the
20 years? I didn't get that. You're still breaking up.
Sorry, what changed in your 20 years in Yukon Aviation? Like, say, from 40 to 60, 41 to 61, what were the changes?
What were the what?
Changes.
The changes?
Yes.
Oh. Oh, God. Lots of changes. Well, originally we charged, we charged so much an hour, and when we had our own charter business, and also when CPA were there, the pilots went out, instead of being paid a salary, they were paid so much a mile, 25 cents a mile plus basic salary of $100 or something like that. Well, I found out that wasn't too good because the guy, he went out and the weather was bad and turned back, he never got paid. You know, he didn't get paid for them because he was getting paid by mileage.
Yeah.
Had to complete the trip.
Yeah.
So they finally, they changed that and they put him on, put a person on a salary basis and so much a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, when we had our own outfit, we charged so much an hour for, like, was $25 an hour for the fleet Canuck, and $60 an hour for a 180, and $80 an hour for a Beaver. And then later on, after I got out of it, sort of, they went to the mileage basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I suppose that was an improvement.
Mm-hmm.
But they, and we also used to do what we called split charters. And then when PWA bought us out, they put the kibosh in it and said, no bloody way, you charge everybody full price. Well, that's a pretty crummy way of doing things, really. You know, if you're going on the trip and you got space, give the guy a break. And that's what we did. And so we had a lot, we had some very good public relations compared to when the Pacific Western took over and so on.
I see.
But it was, things were improving. The aircraft were improving, the maintenance set up, you know, parts availability and so on were improved, and the rules and regulations, they juggled them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That for a long while we had a protected charter, protected rights, nobody could come in and operate out of your base, and you had to stick to the bases you had.
Mm-hmm.
Or to operate as a base.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I had to go down one time to argue for a base at Mayo against Pat Collison, who was a personal friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't give it to either one of us. They said, no, you can both use it, but we're not going to give you a charter. So the rules changed, and then, of course, I got out of it, basically out of it, but I was still, I'd tell my secretary, I said, I'll be out of the office for a few hours, and I did a trip or two for the boys when they were short of, needed some
sort of pilot.
Yeah, gas hauled for helicopter or whatever.
Right.
Well,
it's probably you talked about public relations and things like that. You in whatever office you are, UConn is certainly wasn't a big town then, and you'd help out where you could.
And what?
You would help out where you could.
Oh, sure. Yep.
You know, you don't want to leave your former and even current associates in the lurch if they're stuck, you know, for gas or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and when anybody was overdue, everybody pitched in and went looking for them, it's fairly close. Even today, the aviation industry is a fairly close knit group.
I think those are most of the questions that I have. Those are all the questions I think that I have right now. Anything else you'd like to...
No, I can't think of anything, Colin. I rely on you to get me thinking about these things, I guess.
Okay.
I've thought about them for a long time.
Well, you do pretty well, all right.
It's having to dig back pretty far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do pretty well. So, I'll just turn the tape on.